Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the latest in a special series of banter podcasts from Web Summit 2015 at Dublin's RDS. Peter Nelson is the boxing fan who hit pay dirt. Now the vice president of programming at HBO Sports, Peter started his career as a journalist with Vanity Fair and Sports Illustrated before joining the broadcaster. In this interview, Peter talks to us about who inspired him to start writing in the first place, the great stories around boxing, the characters around the sport, and HBO's place in that particular landscape. Hello and welcome back to the Banter Podcast here from the Web Summit at Dublin's RDS. We're joined now by Peter Nelson, who is the Vice President of Programming at HBO Sports. Welcome along, Peter.
Thank you very much for having me.
So before you landed at HBO, you were in the rag trade. You were a writer. You wrote for Vanity Fair and you wrote for Sports Illustrated or people like that. Like, what got you into writing in the first place?
I've always had an interest in writing, but in particular, in relation with the intersection of sports, one of my favorite writers was A.J. Liebling, who's a writer for The New Yorker for a long time, from the 30s until, I think, 1963 when he died. And he actually revitalized, popularized the phrase, the sweet science. He came up with the phrase, the windy city for Chicago. He's one of the great American writers, and I discovered his writing at a fairly young age, and I was always engaged by it. And so one of the great things that he wrote about was initially food, and that was the point of entry for me. I love reading about food. I love thinking about food. And I explored his other writings after I exhausted that literature. So that went on to his World War II writings, and eventually I came to the boxing writings. And I always kind of put it off because I never figured reading about boxing matches from, you know, 50, 60 years ago would be terribly compelling. And when you got into it, you realized it was the best writing that he ever did.
Yeah, boxing has always attracted brilliant writers. You know, you think of someone like George Kimball, you think of all the classic stuff, you know. What do you think it is about boxing that attracts kind of like great writing?
Well, it facilitates great writing so easily, as you just said. I mean, if as a journalist you can't write compellingly about boxing, then you need to think seriously about switching professions, because it's all pretty much laid out for you in terms of the drama, mano a mano, the psychic ordeals that these guys go through in preparation for these fights, as well as the human interest stories behind them and their lead up into the positions that they're in. Often they come from backgrounds that are unimaginable. And now with the globalization of the sport, you get keyed into all kinds of different storylines and cultural threads that you're creating together in a lattice work that previously was more of just an American experience or maybe a domestic dispute in certain countries individually. But now what you see is that you're putting together the whole framework, and that really is one of the great, beautiful things about the sporting scene today.
Mm. I mean, one thing about like covering boxing, and I'm sure you did it back in your Vanity Fair and Sports Illustrated day as well, is that you get quite close to these characters as well. You know, and like as you said, there's great stories there. Like, I mean, for an average story, how long were you spending? If you were doing a kind of profile on someone, did you have the luxury of spending loads of time to deep reporting and things like that?
I don't know if I would call it luxury, but maybe it was the self-delusion that led me to think it was a good idea to spend that amount of time. But in retrospect, it always feels like time well spent. I mean, one of the things that I like to do is to really live with the subject as much as I possibly could. And so I was covering Manny Pacquiao at one point in time, and we were together almost every day. I was in his camp, and there was a moment where he was reading one of my stories where I was outlining his dietary habits. And he turned to a friend of his and he said, "Who wrote this?" And our man goes, "Peter." And this is in his apartment in LA at the time. And he says, "Who's Peter?" And this friend of his says, "You know Peter." And it was a room full of Manny and his entourage. So I was the only white person there. And Joe points to me and he goes, "He's the white guy back there." And Manny turns around and he looks at me and he says, "You're a writer?" And I said, "Yes." And he goes, "I thought you just liked to hang out." And I was interviewing him every day and we were talking. And, you know, and one of the fascinating things about boxing is that unlike a lot of sports today where there's a lot of media training that goes on and you get kind of sterilized answers for an anesthetized public.
Yeah.
You really have a proximity to the athlete in a way that you don't get in any other sport.
Yeah, and it's also it's very much as well untempered, because I mean, boxing remains that great out of the ghetto, out of the gutter story. You know, it's like, how do you get out of those situations? You through sports, mainly through boxing, or through music. You know, so it's like there's that narrative as well.
It's one of the great aspects of the sport. You know, one of the things about boxing is that you don't need real estate or equipment in order to practice the sport. And so people sometimes struggle with the violence, and I can understand that. But on the other side of it, you have to think that a lot of these kids come from communities where they don't have the recourse of playing golf or tennis or team sports that demand a lot of real estate. They come from communities where often the societies and the communities are from are neglected. And in order to try to create spaces, they're relying upon adults who take a real vested interest in kids and try to give them something that's not looked at as a way to try to turn any kids professional, but as a way of just giving them something that teaches them discipline, teaches them pattern recognition, teaches them skills that they can translate and apply to other things in their lives. And so what you find that from every program that you find that develops some of these children in areas, whether it's St. Louis or Cincinnati or some of the more hardscrabble areas in the United States at least, what you find is that a lot of the kids went on to become quality citizens in their communities. And for every one professional that goes on, there are many that made it out to find a better path.
Did you box yourself?
No, I don't make any pretense to do it. I mess around in the gym a little bit, but just enough to get a black eye or two and learn my lesson, and then I go back into the office.
So what led you, what led you to HBO Sports? I know that they went through a period of kind of hiring in a few boxing writers. Were you in before that?
I was doing freelance work at the time and a bunch of carom shots off this and that, but kind of one interview led to another, and I never really gave it too much thought. There's kind of a Newton's law with big corporations that kind of takes a little bit of time. But working at a large corporation was always anathema to me. It was something that I never really had much interest in doing. As a freelance journalist, I liked the liberty to be able to set my own schedule and be able to explore my own interests. But the leadership at HBO, I have to say, is just fantastic. And they're some of the smartest people that I'll ever have the good fortune of ever meeting. And the idea of being able to come aboard on that mission at a company that prides itself on storytelling, which as a journalist spoke to me, that was a great privilege. And the quality of people there is just outstanding.
Yeah. I mean, and the quality of work as well. I mean, that they're producing. I mean, obviously we know about HBO in terms of like series like, you know, like The Wire and what have you. But like on the sports side as well, I mean, boxing obviously is kind of is one of the big silos there as well. But like, I mean, your documentary strand is pretty strong as well. There's some interesting basketball stuff there. Are you more in terms of like, I mean, is your role really about like, I suppose, broadening that? Or is it mostly about like, I mean, I suppose, making sure that HBO is the place gets the big fights?
Well, my principal role is the matchmaking, negotiations of the fights, and trying to architect the narrative of what those fights are doing, what they're coming from, and where they're going to. And that involves a certain degree, you know, the philosopher Nassim Taleb, he wrote a book called Anti-Fragile. It's this idea that volatility, which can usually be devastating solely, can actually make some systems more beautiful, powerful, gratifying. So the idea is always that if expectations are upended, that you're not left with just the underdog won and now there's nothing to do. That the fights are always going someplace.
Yeah.
And that there's always a story to tell. And a large part of what my job is just creating the birth in the B-E-R-T-H sense for our people, our producers, our artists, our fighters and our promoters and their managers to be able to tell the story that they want to tell. And whether that means artistically, whether that means athletically, and it's up to them once they're in the ring. And the quality of the competition is what provides the authenticity of the experience. That's what people key into on sports. Because, you know, I have a friend who worked in marketing, and he told me once, you know, an inauthentic experience, you can market almost anything. A car, a lipstick, a political candidate. The one thing that you can't do that with is live sports, because it doesn't appeal to your self-esteem, how much money you have, whether or not you're going to get the girl. All of that is aside. All it is just whether or not it's a quality experience or a debased experience.
Yeah.
And it's going to speak to you immediately. as to which one it is.
Yeah. It's hard, like, I mean, the one interesting thing about, like, boxing in the last couple of years, though, Peter, is there has been a renaissance, you know. There's definitely been, like, I mean, a revival, you know. I mean, you're talking there about stories, and I'm kind of, like, I mean, thinking of bouts, and I can kind of see the lines in the sand and how the stories all kind of blend out. What do you think that's down to? Is the thing, is the case that customers have come around to kind of go, like, viewers, audience have come around to wanting more of that, or is it a case of, because of the way it's covered on like, something like HBO, that's leading into this as well?
I think the quality of the competition has been very high, and I think that has a way of building. I think people in general have come to see the sport more globally. What you see, a fighter like Manny Pacquiao, yeah, who ended up becoming such a central star with the Hispanic community in the United States as a native Filipino, very unusual arc. But what you see in boxing is what you see in tennis, is a kind of Genghis Khan effect, where we reassign our allegiance at times because an athlete we once admired is defeated by another in a way we respect. And so then we decide, okay, now we like this guy. And that is about building and constructing a narrative, something that you can architect, and you can't plan on it. There's no Enchiridion in any one particular fighter's path for how to make it happen perfectly. All you can do is try to assess the quality of skill and then try to put those fighters in those situations where they can prove their mettle, because, you know, greatness is more than talent. It's about how an individual chooses to confront moments of adversity or crisis. And that's what people want to see elicited from an athlete.
I mean, obviously, when the boxer gets in the ring, I mean, you do see the greatness. You see all the training coming through. But there's also a team around those boxers. And I'm curious about something, because back in the day, you know, I remember my dad be watching boxing back in the, like 70s when I was growing up. You know, the bouts would be on very late at night here in Ireland because they're coming from Vegas. And, like, you know, you knew about the characters around it. And, like, characters always struck me as shady and dodgy. You know, we call it the Don King effect, without kind of, like, slandering Mr. King. But, like, that effect, has that changed? I mean, has the boxing game been cleaned up? Has it become sort of, like, I mean, has it got rid of a lot of those kind of, like, more interesting, colourful people?
Well, lying in boxing is a bit of a growth industry, but I think that there's been a trend towards seeing that the future is not in a balkanized world. It's in a much more league-oriented sports space. And without a centralized league, I think the principal stakeholders in boxing, who for the large part are the fighters, managers, promoters, what they've keyed into is seeing the success in other spaces, how lucrative that can be. And if you want to maximize what your enterprise can achieve, you're going to have to embrace the norms of today's world. Mm-hmm. And so you've seen very forward-looking companies who have moved entirely away from the kinds of antics that you were referring to earlier. So I think I've been very galvanized to see the ways in which the sport has tried to pivot towards a more forward-looking approach.
I'm curious as well, but, like, you said there as well, you kind of didn't disagree, so we'd say the audience is growing, you know. Has the fact that there's been so much kind of, like, I mean, like, ink and narrative and noise around things like MMA and UFC, has that kind of, like, brought people back to boxing as well? Because, I mean, they look at those experiences sometimes, they don't see them as authentic as it used to be when you just had two lads in the ring slugging it out.
Well, I mean, I don't think that there's any competition between sports. I don't think that people don't watch cricket because they watch baseball, just because they both involve a pitch, you know. But I do think that it's an interesting world right now where the consumer is extremely well-educated, and you underestimate the intelligence of the viewer at your own peril. And people are sophisticated fans of sport. They are passionate about it. They learn deeply about it. Oftentimes, they know details about the individual athletes to a degree that sometimes the athletes themselves don't keep track of. And when you're speaking to that level of consumer, you have to make sure that the quality of what you're presenting them with is going to match the expectation.
Yeah.
And what the expectation is that the expectation will be upended.
Yeah.
That's what it is that you're going to see something unpredictable. It's part of why we like sports, for the controlled chaos that they provide in our lives, which on a day-to-day level is totally unbridled chaos.
Yeah, that uncontrolled chaos though is very good for HBO's bottom line. I mean, I read a stat. I could be wrong that in terms of revenue for the company. I mean, the pay per view revenue is a pretty important kind of part of the budget.
Pay per view revenue is an interesting model, and without getting too much into how the sausage is made, it's a very lucrative model for the athlete. Above all, and it's a lucrative model for the promoter of the event if they've done a good deal with their principals. And so the problem with it is that it narrows the audience to a large degree. You're asking people to come out of their pocket, and people parting with their time is very different than parting with their money. And you better be pretty sure that you have a quality product to deliver, that you're not going to have people coming away feeling disappointed with the experience if you want them to come back.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious as well about going back to something you said earlier on, Peter, about your role in HBO in terms of HBO Sports, in terms of telling that story. Are there kind of situations where you come across athletes that you think would benefit from say that documentary making element? Is that something about making it more than just the action, the actual event? Is that part of your remit?
People gravitate to people. People love reading stories about people. And humanizing fighters is one of the great artistic crafts that I think that our people do so well, is in allowing people a lens into the socioeconomic aspects of sport and the humanity behind the athleticism of what drives people in order to become great at something. And, it's an interesting thing to watch how certain athletes, they can achieve an exceptionally elite level as amateurs or in the gym, but you turn the lights on and they have to walk up those steps into the ring and they get altitude sickness and they just can't perform anymore. It's searching out the athletes who can perform at those levels, but then also who have compelling backstories as well.
Yeah.
Someone who has both is going to be able to engage an audience. Because sometimes people aren't even a fan of the sport, but they become a fan of the story. We have a fighter right now named Gennady Golovkin, goes by Triple G. And he's a Kazakh fighter who started his career in Germany and now lives in California, and he just sold out Madison Square Garden in New York. How does that happen?
Yeah.
Well, to a large degree, it's the quality of the athlete. People identify with the style. They find it exciting. They find it compelling. But in addition to that, I think the press did an incredible job for him because they saw in him someone who was undervalued. And people all feel undervalued. I mean, I have yet to meet the person who thinks they're overpaid. Maybe here at Web Summit I'll find, but generally speaking, I have never met that person. And so chances are at any given point in time when you're talking to anyone, they're probably feeling slightly undervalued. And Golovkin, as a fighter who was undervalued, he had about, 350 amateur fights. He lost five of them. He's knocked out all of his opposition for the most part. And he was thought to have not really been given a fair shake. And I think everyone can understand and relate to a situation where they were interested in only having the opportunity to show that they could do the task. And I thought the press really did a magnificent job of rallying around him, championing him, and delivering that story. And what you're seeing is people gravitating to it. Terrence Crawford, another fighter, he's from Omaha. Omaha doesn't really have any home teams particularly, and he's become kind of the local franchise because he's given the people in the community a sense of, this is our city. Most people from Omaha, whether it's Marlon Brando or Fred Astaire, they leave Omaha to go on an odyssey. He went on an odyssey to become the fighter that he is, and then he came back.
Yeah.
And people gravitate to that, and people champion that, and it becomes a kind of epicenter of a little earthquake that begins rippling out and out and out to the point where now I'm here in Ireland, and we're talking about kids from Omaha and Kazakhstan. And that's part of the beauty of the sport. It's part of why I love it so much.
Yeah. I mean, you talked earlier on there, Peter, about the global effect on boxing, you know, and looking at Triple G from Kazakhstan, for example. I mean, there's a couple of boxing narratives here in Ireland. I'm curious to see, have they made any impact in the States? One is the kind of Katie Taylor story, you know, the female boxer who's won loads of Olympic medals. And the other story would be Billy Walsh, the kind of like the Irish boxing coach who's been tapped by the US Olympics team to coach them for next year. Have those stories made any impact with you?
With me personally,
yeah,
I follow them, and obviously the amateur system is one that I have a keen interest in, because those are the kids that become the future of the sport. And a lot of the time, again, these kids, they come from programs in local communities, and there's no aspiration to even leave your hometown often when you're from some of these places, but the talent sometimes takes them there. And that's one of the beautiful things about sport, is that it can open your eyes to other places. It's culturally a glue that binds us in a lot of ways. And it's also something that's a lens into another world. I mean, when you travel, one of the great things to do is that you can see art that's local. You can eat food that's local. And if you really know someone who's local, they'll take you to a sporting event.
Yeah.
And that's really how to experience it.
Yeah. Do you think women's boxing will ever take off? From the point of view of your audience, and I suppose boxing consumers, is women's boxing something that they want to see more of?
I hope. If we're doing our jobs right.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's narratives being built constantly in the sport, and that people will seize upon an individual athlete who has an ability to transcend the casual sports fan's appetite. And it's hard, you know, because I think the general fan, the casual fan, doesn't really want to spend more time than learning one or two names in any given discipline, whether it's soccer or baseball or football, American football, whatever it is. So in boxing, I think they're looking for who are the big, big names. I'll key into that. If someone else comes along and beats those guys, then I'll learn that guy's name.
Yeah.
And on and on. So the question is, how do you figure out how to get a third name into that pantheon and keep people engaged? Because the more you have that built presence, that's going to be the fulcrum on which you're really going to be able to grow the franchise.
Okay. Final question, Peter. Thank you very much for your time. Final question. I mean, like, you've been at HBO now a couple of years. I mean, are you happy to stay there for a bit longer? What would you like to do next?
Gorgeous company. Gorgeous company. I'd stay there as long as they'll have me.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you.
Thanks a million to Peter for joining us at Banter, and Mary, Eleanor, Mike, and all of the Web Summit media team for their help with this series. This podcast was recorded and produced by Garrett Hines, and thanks to Erica from Bodytonic for her assistance. We hope you've enjoyed this interview. Please remember to check out our other podcasts from Web Summit 2015 and, of course, our regular series of Banter podcasts. You can find these and details of all upcoming Banter events at thisisbanter.com. We'll talk to you soon.